You're listening to Radio Diaries.
Demonstrations against the South African government's strict apartheid policies flare into shocking violence.
A 42-year-old African lawyer, Nelson Mandela, the most dynamic leader in South Africa today. He is still underground.
I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people.
On April 20th, 1964, in a stuffy South African courtroom, Nelson Mandela stood up, and rather than testify in his own defense, he gave a marathon speech. "I am prepared to die." Those are the last five words of the speech, and they're well known today. Less well known are the 10,693 other words in the speech. It lasted 4 hours. An audio recording of that speech was made by a court stenographer on a dictabelt, a plastic recording that was never intended to preserve history. The recording was lost and forgotten for almost four decades until it was discovered in the basement archive of the South African Broadcasting Corporation. I know that basement well. It may sound odd, but I spent many happy weeks there in 2003 surrounded by stacks of reel-to-reel tapes, searching for sound to tell the history of apartheid for our series Mandela and Audio History. I remember standing in that basement archive and thinking about all the stories that might be lost on unmarked reels and all the stories that were never even recorded. So many of the people who sacrificed in real ways while fighting against apartheid have died over the last decade. Some of them may still be remembered in years to come. Others will be forgotten. Mandela was the voice for all of them. Today on the podcast, we're celebrating the life and legacy of Nelson Mandela with our hour-long documentary, Mandela, an Audio History. It's hosted by Desmond Tutu, and it features the voices of those who fought with Mandela and against him. We begin with an introduction Mandela recorded back in 2004.
My name is Nelson Mandela. I look back to the achievements not of individuals, but to the achievements of collective action. A group of men and women, that is the nature of our struggle. Without that struggle, we would still be under apartheid. It is always important to look at your history. You can't really be proud of yourself if you don't know your history.
This is Desmond Tutu. In 1994, the world watched as millions of South Africans cast their ballots in our country's first fully democratic election. After all the votes were counted, Nelson Mandela was president of a new South Africa. Mandela's journey from freedom fighter to president is one of the most dramatic stories of our lifetime. But many have never heard the story from those of us who lived and struggled in South Africa in the days of hatred and bigotry and violence. So here then is Mandela, an audio history.
The program that follows is about the people of South Africa.
1935, 1940, 1945. A nation develops into the premier industrial power on the African continent.
The Golden City, South Africa's Johannesburg. Millions of pounds worth of gold comes out of Joburg each year. With this wealth, the people of the city live well and happily. Truly, this is the finest of all the world's golden cities.
As a white citizen, you had social status, you had beautiful schools, you had parks, you had everything that you desire, and you had the highest standard of living in the world. The blacks were just pushed out.
The population of South Africa was about 10 million. 2 million and a bit were whites and dominated everything. And there were gold mines and diamond mines with huge economic potential based on very cheap black labour.
It was a master-servant relationship. We had domestic staff who were black, but they lived in their own quarters. They were the nannies and the cleaners and the gardeners.
We were taught that the whites were superior people. And we were told when we were young that if you do good in this life, your next life will become better. And I remember promising myself that I'm going to be a good little boy so that my next life I wanted to be a white person. That was my goal in life. And I determined to be a good boy.
We come from far away places to the golden city. We've left our parents miles and miles away.
By 1940, I mean, you had this flood of people coming into the cities. And Mandela went to Johannesburg to work.
Lord, make us one.
I remember when I arrived in Johannesburg in the early 40s, the fear, you know, of the power of the white man inhibited us a great deal, and the government was becoming very tough.
News from Government House Pretoria, where South Africa's newly elected Prime Minister, Dr. Malan, was sworn in at the beginning of a new chapter in South Africa's history.
At the time of the 1948 elections, the Nationalist Party under D.F. Malan preached what they called Baaskap. Baaskap is an Afrikaans word to express white domination.
The colour question is rapidly increasing in seriousness and urgency. I consider apartheid, that's the separation policy, to be South Africa's last chance to remain a white man's country.
Well, the appeal was survival. The appeal was, we are a small minority on a black continent, and we number so many millions, and the black number X times that millions. And if we are to survive in Africa, and here we are, and we've been here since 1652, we have got to survive. And the way to survive is to maintain domination. Simple as that.
I remember I came out of Park Station that morning and bought a newspaper and learned that the National Party had won. And Comrade Oliver Tambo said, well, I like this, because we now know that we have an enemy in power. And I think that we're going to have a better opportunity of mobilizing our people. So when they came into power, it became clear that we were going to be put under a very severe test.
In these circumstances, the government has decided on the following measures. A prohibition on meetings has been...
And immediately after 1948, the apartheid government announced that it was introducing a new series of laws.
The Group Areas Act. There was an Immorality Act so that you couldn't have sexual relations across the colour line. Race classification, which laid down for all time your colour and your category, white, coloured, Indian, or black.
The coloured man must always carry these passes.
Photographs are taken at the offices of the Department of Native Affairs. Daily, a large number turns up here for reference books. Each book contains the photograph of the owner, his name, race, and particulars of employment.
They use this crude method of putting a pencil through your hair. If the pencil sticks, then you are black or African. If it falls off, you've got a chance of being classified coloured.
Naturally, the officials who are employed here must have a thorough knowledge of Bantu customs and languages.
Each time you left your home, you had to make sure that you have a little book in your pocket. And if you didn't have that piece of paper, some ignorant, stupid youngster in the police force could stop you and demand that you identify yourself. If you couldn't, they locked you up.
At 9 o'clock, a big bell would ring, dong, dong, and you knew that was for you, if you were black, to get out of the white city.
Dr. Malan unomthetho nzima. Dr. Malan unomthetho nzima. Dr. Malan has got very strange rules. He's stopping me from doing that and this and the other in my own land. And people in the street would start singing, Dr. Malan unomthetho nzima. Andazuguba soshona pi.
In the 50s, the apartheid structure was tightening. Situation was becoming so much worse, you know.
And as Uguba soshona pi.
The communities, they'd been intimidated, cowed down, but we knew the feeling among the vast majority of the people was that this system cannot continue and must do something about it.
In Johannesburg, premier city of South Africa, there was staged last weekend the first move in a campaign that may lead to civil disobedience. Thousands of colored people went to attend a protest meeting called by the African National Congress. This is the most important African organization in the Union, and it called on all colored people to protest against the racial segregation laws. A crowd of some thousands made their way to the meeting.
We now began to feel that the time had come for the emergence of a mass organization to go out into the highways and organize the masses of the people.
You needed somebody to lead the people. You needed somebody who could make the people believe in the organization. Mandela had what it took to actually be out there in the front, leading the movement.
Since then, the Congress leaders have announced that they will decide later this month whether to launch a civil disobedience campaign. This would urge all colored people to break the unjust laws and to court arrest.
The first thing we did was the defiance campaign of 1952, when the ANC decided that all the unjust laws would simply be broken. You know, to be part of that kind of movement, to defy the laws and be arrested, and Christ, I mean, it was exciting. We knew that we could do something.
And for 8,500 people to be arrested at the time in 1952 was no small achievement. The mood had been created that our struggle was reaching a dimension where it could not be crushed.
In 1960, on the 21st of March, the PAC, Pan-African Congress, made preparations to launch an anti-pass campaign.
So on this particular day, word went out that all pass books must be burnt to actually light up these passes and burn them. The slogan was, away with the passes. The atmosphere was electric, you know, to join in the bonfire, you know. I remember that vividly. You know, as a kid, you know, you always love to see fire. You know. It was fun, I mean. But of course, later in the day, we heard news came over the radio.
Here is a special announcement. The Governor General has proclaimed a state of emergency in about 80 of the 300 magisterial districts of the Union.
Several hundred natives gathered peaceably to protest the pass laws. Police mounted on tanks opened fire. 69 natives were killed, 176 wounded. Most of the victims were shot in the back. Some of the dead were children, women, and elderly men.
Here were people just marching to the police station to hand over a passbook, and the police opened fire on them. For the first time, it showed the world how brutal the apartheid system could be.
The Prime Minister, Dr. Verwoerd, assured the country that law and order would be maintained. If necessary, the defense force would be called in.
There was a mood among people following the Sharpeville massacre that we had to start dealing with the armed forces of the state, the armed might of the apartheid state.
We felt, you know, it just cannot continue.
Watch out, Verwoerd. The black man will get you. Watch out, Verwoerd. The world sings with me.
The ANC had been declared illegal during the state of emergency. So Oliver Tambo was sent out of the country, and some of the other leaders followed. Mandela, it was decided, should stay in the country, and he carried on his work underground. But one of the things he had is a beard. So it was well known in flyers, on photographs, this man with his beard. It was a very nice little beard. And when he went underground, we thought the first thing he had to do is to shave off his beard. He wouldn't. He just refused.
I went to see a 42-year-old African lawyer, Nelson Mandela, the most dynamic leader in South Africa today. The police were hunting for him at the time, but African nationalists had arranged for me to meet him at his hideout. He is still underground. This is Mandela's first television interview. I asked him what it was that the African really wanted.
The Africans require the franchise on the basis of one man, one vote. They want political independence.
Now, if Dr. Verwoerd's government doesn't give you the kind of concessions that you want sometime soon, is there any likelihood of violence?
There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people. And I think the time has come for us to consider whether the methods which we have applied so far are adequate.
I had made a statement where I called for armed struggle. Naturally, there was a great deal of resistance from the leadership, but I believed that we were moving into that situation because the government had left us with no other alternative.
The adoption of an armed struggle after a struggle that had been well known for its non-violent and peaceful character was somewhat startling.
The Gandhian concept, in our view, couldn't work in South Africa. In India, the British colonial administration could pack up and go home. But that would not happen in South Africa. There were, at the time, 2 or 3 million whites who were part of South Africa. They'd been here so long. These people were not going home. And so, in the ANC, we set about creating an underground, illegal fighting force to make sure that South Africans and the world would know what's going on.
Mandela then started looking for a name. What are we going to call this movement? And he suggested the Xhosa name Umkhonto weSizwe, which meant spear of the nation. Umkhonto weSizwe.
At the end of 1961, the bombing campaign started. Its targets, power supplies, post offices, telephone booths and pass offices. Objects, not people. The aim was to shock the government into negotiating.
One of their objects was to destroy the records of the passes they detest having to carry.
There were explosions, many in Johannesburg, power pylons, government pass offices. They weren't just random, callous explosions that just happened to be. There had to be an understanding by the mass of the people that organized armed resistance had started. The only deaths were our own people who were careless with their explosives.
As far as the government of South Africa is concerned, the breakdown of law and order in South Africa will not be tolerated under any circumstances whatsoever.
We were branded terrorists by the whole Western world. I mean, they'd have nothing to do with us. Well, as somebody has said, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Asikatali no mabesbopa sizimisele inkululeko.
Of course it would have been naive for us to think we could stand in battle against an army, air force, navy, police force, reservists of 400,000 people. But if you don't have crazy dreams, you do nothing.
We don't care whether they arrest us,
They torture us. We are prepared to fight for our freedom.
We used to sing a song. One stick, two sticks, six sticks of dynamite will take the country, the Castro way. Now, remember, Castro's campaign was a very short campaign. Within a space of 2 years, they had overrun Cuba. So here we were, the comrades were all singing this song, as if to say in 6 months' time we'd be free. 6 months' time we were languishing in prison.
Mandela, he had addressed a meeting in Durban. He was coming back, and the police stopped them. And they asked him what was his name, and he said, David. And they said, you're under arrest, Mr. Mandela.
A remarkable demonstration by a crowd of several hundred outside the courthouse in Pretoria. Nelson Mandela, leader and founder of the sabotage movement Spirit of the Nation and a leading member of African National Congress, accused with the others of plotting sabotage to overthrow the South African government by force.
There were eight of us in the trial. And the first day the lawyer said, chaps, prepare for the worst.
Firstly, the state alleges the planned purpose thereof was to bring about chaos, disorder and turmoil in the battle to be waged against the white man in this country.
They were called terrorists. We knew that there was no hope of getting an acquittal. The question was, what do we do with a trial? Our approach was one of defiance, because we said, it is the government that is a criminal and that should be standing in the dock to face their trial. We are not guilty.
That, my lord, is the case for the state.
When the defense case started, Mandela, he was going to be the first defense witness. And the prosecution had prepared extensively to cross-examine Mandela and break him down. And they all got a shock when our lawyers announced that Mandela will not give evidence, but he'll make a statement from the dock.
The courtroom was absolutely packed. He stood up and he proceeded to deliver the speech.
I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people. I know this sounds revolutionary to the whites in this country because the majority of voters will be Africans. This makes the white man fear democracy.
That was a four-hour speech.
And I have fought.
But that last bit where he said, these are the ideas for which I'm prepared to die.
I have checked.
Just that last bit.
I knew what he was going to say because we'd all seen the speech. Everybody had made comments about it. And I knew he was going to say, in effect, hang me if you dare to, Mr. Judge. But only when he said it.
I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
There was dead silence. Nobody said anything. Even the judge didn't know what to say. I knew it was a moment of history. He emerged then as a great leader.
Yes, Your Lord. Very well, the court may adjourn.
The possibility of a death sentence, of course, worried me. And I remember we adjourned for lunch. It was a very hot day, and a friendly African warder asked me the question, Mandela, what do you think is going to happen to you in this case? I said to him, they are going to hang us. Now, I was really expecting some word of encouragement from him. And I thought he was going to say, Manisi, that can never happen. But he became serious. And then he said, I think you're right. They're going to hang you.
The next day, armed police massed in even greater force as Mr. Justice De Wet was passing sentence.
I am by no means convinced that the motive of the accused were as altruistic as they wish the court to believe.
When they said, stand up for your sentence, we thought, well, here it comes.
I have decided not to impose the supreme penalty, which in a case like this would usually be the proper penalty for the crime. That is the only leniency I can show. The sentence in the case of all the accused will be one of life imprisonment.
And we laughed. We turned to each other and laughed. Because we expected to be hanged.
At the back entrance to the Pretoria Court, large crowds gather to watch the accused being driven away to start their life sentences.
There have been growing protests from all over the world today at the sentence of life imprisonment passed in South Africa on Friday on this man, Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela did become the symbol of the struggle for liberation in South Africa. People could identify with Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela the lawyer, Nelson Mandela the hero, Nelson Mandela the handsome man. But it was the response to his Rivonia trial speech, called throughout the world the I Am Prepared to Die speech, which kind of somersaulted him and the African National Congress and the need to put an end to apartheid into the world consciousness.
As we were being flown to Robben Island, one tried to accept the reality that we may in fact spend years in prison. But we believed very strongly that we would not die in jail. We would return. But we stayed there for 27 years.
This is the site of South Africa's top security jail, Robben Island, a narrow pencil of land off Cape Town, 7 miles out in the South Atlantic. These watchtowers stand guard over men who millions of black South Africans regard as their government in exile.
We landed at Robben Island. There's big iron gates. And every gate bangs behind me, bangs behind me. And then the warder opened one of the doors of the cell, wooden doors, and then he opened the grill and he just shoved me. And there was my bucket and a couple of blankets. And that was my first night.
We worked at the lime quarry. We'd never done pick and shovel work before. So every day we had bleeding hands and blisters. It was very, very hot. When we started working there, we were told that we'd work there for 6 months. We in fact worked there for about 13 years.
In the lime quarry, most of the time you're leaning on your shovel or your pickaxe, but all of the time you're in a group of people discussing things.
I mean, every single man on the island was a book, so to speak, and you could really learn from each one of them.
Our universe were 30 people. We were completely isolated.
They put us into a section on the island called the terrorist camp, and we were called the Terries. Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, people that they identified as leaders.
It was to a very large extent a mistake for the regime to bring us together. In spite of the fact that we're in prison, we were able to stand away from ourselves and to discover the weaknesses and the mistakes that we made in the course of our struggle.
People would say that life in prison is very tedious. But nobody wandered around, bored, doing nothing. And if I wanted to see you, I needed to make an appointment with you. Can you believe that in prison I have to make an appointment to see somebody when I'm locked up with you for 24 hours a day? And people were pretty strict about it. I couldn't go up to somebody and say, okay, can we have a chat about this? No, we can't. I'm booked. But I ended up being like that because if you didn't have appointments, your life would have been unstructured and meaningless.
Asikatali noma besbopa sizimisele inkululeko.
My family lived under very difficult conditions without a head of the family who could support them, give them the love and the security which they deserved.
My name is Zinzi Mandela. When my father went to prison, I was 18 months old. So I think I was about 13, 14 when I saw him for the first time.
The following rules are applicable to all visitors to Robben Island. No parcels or articles.
I thought he would hold me, you know. I thought he would lift me in the air, you know, maybe spin me around. But obviously that didn't happen. The reality was that I had to see him behind this glass partition, and we spoke through a telephone. There were warders on either side of us, interrupting the conversation and saying, you cannot speak about that. Whose name is that? You cannot talk about that person. For many years, I never saw my father standing, because you would walk in there and find him seated already. So I had no idea even how tall he was. For him, it can't have been easy.
Well, I think in the nature of the apartheid system, they had no option but to bury us alive. No newspaper was allowed to publish a photograph of a prisoner. They hoped that way the public would simply forget us.
Cape Town glowed in warm, sunny weather today for one of its most colourful ceremonies, the opening of Parliament. It was opened at noon by the President, Mr. Fouché.
The Republic has enjoyed a year of peace and tranquility.
All political movements were banned. Everything was quiet, ostensibly. In terms of the struggle, we were in the doldrums.
Protest, agitation completely died out. And yet, under the surface, it continued to bubble.
They had locked up Mandela in jail, but they hadn't looked around to say, where are their children and what are they doing?
The student movement and the leadership of people like Steve Biko, there arose a group imbued with the spirit of black consciousness. You could feel it. You could feel that something had to give. It happened on June the 16th.
Teach yourself Afrikaans.
Good evening, listeners. Let us start off by getting to know all the Afrikaans sounds. Lach, dag en nach.
Afrikaans is a hybridization, if you like, of Dutch. It's a language that was used by the rulers.
Thank you.
And the black children hated Afrikaans with a passion.
1975, an Afrikaans is exactly 100 years old. To pay homage to the Afrikaans language, pupils of the school present a play in Afrikaans.
Every school day began with an assembly of all the kids, and one day there's an announcement.
I'm going to speak to you about Bantu education, the education of a million Bantu children.
As of today, every subject would be taught in Afrikaans.
To introduce the teaching of Afrikaans,
and the teacher walks in, history becomes geskiedenis. And we're all like, what are you talking about? He says, I don't know either. And that didn't work. Whole classes failed. When they did that, they actually mobilized the entire school generation.
At 8:15 in the morning, and precisely according to plan, students simultaneously marched out of five schools in Soweto, intending to protest the Afrikaans issue in a mass meeting at the Orlando football stadium.
We had hundreds, probably thousands, of school kids. And we thought we know everything there is to know about managing protests. The first thing we're worried about is that everyone must be accounted for at all times. So we then had chains of 5 kids. And make sure you're holding somebody's hand all the time. If not holding somebody's hand, get worried, because where is your partner?
Then it became really a torrent, a sea of young black faces. And at that point, opposite, the police tried to stop the march from going on to Orlando Stadium.
I've never seen that many police. And you didn't only have police at that time, you had the defense force. So you actually had the army. I mean, there's a group of kids. Kids with shining black shoes and little white socks and teeny little tunics. And they're singing freedom songs, holding one another. We actually looked cute. It's unbelievable to think that anyone could have stood firm on their feet and actually shot into that crowd. We had hundreds of school kids running helter-skelter, running all over the place. We had planned for water pipes. We had planned for maybe rubber bullets. We had not planned or thought that it's possible that people were actually going to be killed on that day.
The mayhem went all over Soweto. The following day, it went on all over the country. And really, South Africa was on fire.
Since June the 16th, when South African troops and police opened fire on a peaceful school children's demonstration, the white government has presided over the largest massacre of its black population since South Africa came into existence.
When you see your friends being shot at for just walking in the street, it does something to you. And therefore you would look around. What are the alternatives? Do I become like my mother, forever be under the yoke of apartheid? And the alternative was for me to not be like my mom, great as she was, but to go and fight.
Information kept on coming through the prison walls about what was going on. The significance of the 1976 uprising was that the government actually produced one of the most rebellious generation of African youth. They were very militant, they were very brave, and there is nothing as encouraging to a prisoner than to know that the ideas for which you are suffering will never die.
1976 was the turning point. Black people had made up their mind. We're not taking this anymore. And South Africa was never the same again.
This is Radio Freedom, the voice of the African National Congress.
The South African security forces believe there are at least 4,000 guerrillas under training in camps in Mozambique, Angola, and other frontline states. The guerrillas sing of the man they regard as their leader, the jailed nationalist Nelson Mandela. Show us the way to victory, say the words. Freedom is in your hands.
In the 80s, black resistance had grown enormously.
The mass movement in this country, the political movement, the armed struggle, the world opinion was all turning against the government.
Uniquely in the world, the struggle took on the character of a race issue, the issue of humanity itself. It made this a worldwide phenomenon.
Hello.
Yes,
I'm calling from Holland. I'd like to speak to Mrs. Mandela, please.
Speaking.
I'm calling from the Dutch radio.
Yes.
Winnie Mandela is her husband's voice in the world outside. Yes, the government has tried to silence her. For nearly 20 years, she's been living under virtual house arrest.
Your husband has been in prison now for 22 years. It is incredible that he is still the most popular leader in South Africa.
He is a symbol of the aspirations of the black people of this country.
In the
early 80s, the world in some sense became obsessed by this political prisoner.
Our thoughts are with you.
Thank you so much for your solidarity.
We will meet in freedom.
Certainly, Amanda.
Amanda, great. Thank you very much, Mrs. Mandela.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Sometimes I think the fact that he was in prison and could make no speeches and therefore could make no mistakes, it's as if the government had done us a favor by locking him up all those many years.
50,000 birthday cards from the people of Holland were delivered to Nelson Mandela's wife, Winnie. World champion boxer Mike Tyson sent his gloves for Mandela.
I think the government was always terrified that he'd die in prison. They were between a rock and a hard place. If he died in prison, not only would he be a martyr, but I think they feared that the world would believe they'd bumped him off, that they'd assassinated him in some way. On the other hand, they were afraid to let him out because they didn't know what would happen.
After months of brutal infighting, President P.W. Botha was forced from office today in a dramatic cabinet coup. Botha's successor, F.W. de Klerk, and his associates are faced with convincing a skeptical international community that they have policies for South Africa which will forever bury the concept of apartheid.
Before I became president, in the latter part of the 80s, the options were limited. One option was a military option. Hard fist, continue, hold on to power, suppress. Another option would be to string things out, to negotiate, but really not to negotiate. To give in a little bit here, do a little thing there, and to just stretch it out.
He knew perfectly well he could stay in power. With the army and the police, you can carry on for quite a long time if you're prepared to shoot, to use violence if necessary. But I don't think de Klerk was prepared to shoot.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the state president.
The opening speech in the beginning of the year 1919 was the most well-kept secret in my whole political career.
Our country and all its people have been embroiled in conflict, tension, and violent struggle for decades. Today, I'm able to announce far-reaching decisions. The steps that have been decided are the following. The prohibition of the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the South African Communist Party, and a number of subsidiary organizations is being rescinded. I wish to put it plainly that the government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally. I am serious about bringing this matter to finality without delay. The time for negotiation has arrived.
If I may, I'd like to recap what we've just heard from President de Klerk. He has announced that at 3 p.m. tomorrow, Johannesburg time, Nelson Mandela will finally be released after 27 years behind bars.
When F.W. de Klerk made that speech, he believed that if you released Mandela, who'd become an icon in prison, a living martyr, if you released him, he would quickly be shown to be fallible. Old, out of touch, demythologized was the word they used. And all this was wrong.
You join us at the Victor Verster prison where the excitement is running high. People halfway up trees, standing on their toes, clinging to the wires, trying to get the best possible view any moment now. If we can just spot Mr. Mandela. There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa. And a salute from Mr. Nelson Mandela, his wife Winnie, greeting the people, his first public appearance in nearly three decades. 72 years old, walking strongly, step by step. And one wonders, what must be passing through Mr. Mandela's mind at this moment.
When I saw that crowd, I must confess that I didn't have the courage and the confidence, you know, to speak to them. I never imagined that there would be such crowds. Rather took me by surprise. I think it took more than an hour for us just to go through the crowd to be able to go to the platform.
Today, the majority of South Africans, black and white, recognize that apartheid has no future. Amandla! Amandla! In Africa!
For the first time in 78 years, the African National Congress is talking to the white minority government. Its leader, Nelson Mandela, publicly welcomed by the president who freed him less than 3 months ago.
We are here as fellow South Africans, convinced that the system of white minority rule must come to an end without delay.
From the early 60s, in the minds of most of the whites of this country, Mandela was simply regarded as a terrorist. And now I must sit with his men around a table.
To start negotiations with a government which had throughout the years repeated that they would never sit down and talk to a terrorist organization was a highly sensitive matter.
When we started negotiations, Mr. Mandela, his very first opening statement, for at least 20 minutes or more, he made a study of the Afrikaner history, merely telling us, look, I know you, and I respect what you've gone through. He didn't come up with a statement of bitterness, retribution. No. A man, after 27 years of being robbed of his freedom, and to then come forward and start negotiations on that basis, remarkable. There's no way you can argue against that.
It was the work he'd done in this harsh prison of making it his business to get into the heart and the mind of his adversary. And that's the key to everything. You've got to understand your adversary.
After 3 days of historic discussions, first President de Klerk and then Mr. Mandela appeared to face the press together, their handshake evidence of the progress made.
It didn't come easily. We had breakdowns, we had setbacks, people would storm out of meetings. But things seemed to be going well until fairly early in 1992, we had total breakdown.
Good evening. Prospects for peace are fading. At least 31 people have died since violence erupted in Soweto yesterday.
The most powerful image of violence in South Africa is no longer a confrontation between black and white, but between black and black.
The more conservative Zulus, led by Chief Gotcha Buthelezi, challenged Mandela's right to speak for all blacks. Blacks are killing blacks in a steadily worsening tribal war.
Cars and houses torched, an alleged Inkatha supporter necklaced with a burning tire. A policeman sobbed outside his blazing home, set alight by neighbors who accused the police of involvement in the massacre.
The military security forces and the police were engaged in this. They were providing weapons. They organized raids. They constituted what Mandela called a third force.
Nelson Mandela accused the government of complicity in the killings. The large rally cheered as Mr. Mandela announced that he'd suspended talks with the government.
I can no longer explain to our people why we continue to talk to a government which is murdering our people.
That war between the Zulu tribe and left-wing blacks has become a lot deadlier in recent days, and that is bound to make whites in this country even more anxious. Widespread violence to go with their now uncertain political and economic future.
The reaction of white South Africa was, as usual, divided.
Many left-wing whites would join Nelson Mandela's ANC, but most are in an expanding center, the majority who accept change but are worried.
The whites simply were afraid of giving up the power that they had, that they exercised for more than 300 years. And they could see this slipping out of their hands. And some of the right-wingers, the white right-wing, tried to derail the process.
Approximately 10:25 this morning, Mr. Hani drove up to his house, got out, and at the same moment, another car stopped behind Mr. Hani's car. Shots were fired by a white man at close range.
Chris Hani was the head of Mkhonto we Sizwe, the armed wing of the ANC, immensely popular person. He would draw the biggest crowd of any leader in the country, Mandela included.
I'm unfortunate to announce that Mr. Hani has been killed instantly.
When he was shot down after he'd been out jogging, there was an extraordinary eruption of anger in the country. That was the most terrible moment.
There have been numerous incidents of rioting and other violence. And to report on the situation in Durban, we have Dirk Dippenaar reporting from a portable phone.
And it is a riot. The police have now cocked their rifles. The mob is starting to run back. There's chaos in the centre of Durban right now. Hundreds of policemen are coming out. They've got bulletproof vests on, an ANC marshal.
Hello, Dirk.
President de Klerk and the government realised that they were now powerless to control the situation. And that very night, Mandela went on television to appeal to the country for calm.
We say to all South Africans, black and white, this killing must stop. Our pain and anger is real, yet we must not permit ourselves to be provoked by those who seek to deny us the very freedom Chris Hani gave his life for.
It was his intervention on television that kept the country calm. That night, effectively, Mandela became president of the country.
On the final day of campaigning in South Africa's non-racial election, a huge explosion has caused death and injury near the Johannesburg offices of the African National Congress.
No one has claimed responsibility, but it's assumed to be the work of the far right, which has threatened to disrupt the election. The effect of this kind of action may well be to deter people from voting.
It was a very explosive situation right in the final days of the transition. I mean, nothing in South Africa has ever been dull. We went to the brink several times, but there was no way of going backwards.
It's 7 o'clock on the morning of the 27th of April 1994. Polling stations have opened and thousands of people queue up to cast their vote at ballot stations. And we see that Mr. Mandela is busy casting his vote at this moment.
Vote ANC for peace in our land. Now is the time. Vote Mandela for president. Vote ANC.
In many black and coloured areas, queues began forming at 4 o'clock this morning as first-time voters streamed to the polls. Thousands of people were already queuing before 7 o'clock outside polling stations at Soshanguve near Pretoria and at Soweto. The Red Cross said people should wear a hat, take a bottle of water, a snack and some boiled sweets in case of long delays.
Yeah, well, it was a crazy day. To think, that I had to wait until I was 62 years of age. Nelson Mandela was 76 years of age before we voted in the land of our birth.
A man of 101 years old voted for the first time at Addo in the Eastern Cape last night. Although unable to say much, the man appeared jubilant.
It just was overwhelming to see all these people in long queues who couldn't even complete their voting in the one day. It had to continue the next day. And we're prepared to stand there in the sun and rain and to travel miles to go and put an X against a name. And I wondered to myself, what is it about casting a vote?
I, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa.
Huge crowds. The day when Nelson Mandela was inaugurated, the first democratically elected president of South Africa.
And to devote myself to the well-being of the Republic and all its people.
Will you please raise your right hand and say, so help me God.
So help me God.
And you sat there and looked at the benches of the newly elected legislators, and there were all these terrorists as they had been regarded by the former apartheid government, and there they were sitting. Many had been on Robben Island, many had been tortured, and many of us kept having to pinch ourselves to say, no man, I'm dreaming.
On that day, everyone who was at the inauguration will admit that the most exciting thing of that day was when the jets, just at the right time, they flew over the crowd. I think it was just the idea of people suddenly realizing in mass that those are now ours. They don't belong to the white apartheid regime anymore. They belong to us, to all the people. We are the government now.
Mandela and Audio History originally aired on NPR in 2004. It was produced by myself and Sujay Johnson and edited by Ben Shapiro and Deborah George. You can learn more about the people in this documentary on our website, mandelahistory.org. I'm Joe Richman. Thanks for listening. Sapela isizwe sicijonga makulu.